So in its simplest form, belonging is that feeling of being part of something and mattering to others. That they care about us, that they would notice if we weren't feeling okay, they would notice if we were missing. Really feeling like you authentically belong in a community. So we're wired for that. We're wired to need that. We're essentially a tribal species designed to live and work and love other people in community. A lot of our biology is dedicated to that. And we feel like we belong or don't belong in these various circles we're part of.
This is Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Dr. Cindy Pace, Vice President and Global Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at MetLife. Our podcast examines the pivotal role people play in creating inclusive workplaces that are built for the future. How does inclusion impact our well-being? Why is it a business imperative? In each episode, we weave together storytelling and research-driven conversations with globally recognized authors, experts, and DEI practitioners. On the show, we tackle steps that each of us can take to advance DEI. Before we get on with the show, I'm so excited to share that Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter, is now a global chart topper. While we still are fairly a new show, our podcast has been ranking consistently in the top 250 management podcasts on Apple Podcasts in the US, UK, and many other markets, including Japan, Romania, and Lebanon. If you haven't already, I hope you take time to rate and review our show and share it with others. I appreciate all of you for your support. In today's episode, we're talking about connection. And there's no one better to help us dive deep into this topic than Dr. Britt Andriotta. Britt is a thought leader on how brain science affects teams and work environments. She's a consultant and author of multiple books on how we, as humans, are wired. They're called Wired to Grow, Wired to Resist, and finally, Wired to Connect. We talked about psychological safety, how evolution has affected our minds, and belonging in hybrid work environments. And all of those topics are connected by, well, connection. According to Britt, connection is one of the most fundamental things we long for. I have to tell you, I could have talked to Britt for hours and made 3 episodes of this podcast with her, but we packed a lot into this conversation.
I was learning about neuroscience in my therapy sessions, the amygdala hijack, and I started really being curious about neuroscience and what it might tell us about how the brain learns. So just out of my own curiosity and to be better at my craft, I started looking at the studies and reading the science and figuring it out. And I was really astounded. And so it turned into a lunch and learn talk. And then everyone was like, oh my gosh, you need to make this a book. Started doing the talk on conference circuits. And so that became my first book, Wired to Grow. And now there's a second edition out. And it was really interesting to read the science, but also then synthesize the science into something that is accessible for people and that we can use every day.
Wired to Grow talks about the neuroscience behind learning and how our brains are set to discover new things and master new skills. At the time Britt wrote the book, she was the chief learning officer at lynda.com.
And then right after that, LinkedIn acquired lynda.com. And I'm certified in all the change models and was a change management expert. And I realized that nothing was working. Like none of the models were explaining what we were going through or the emotional upheaval we were feeling, even though we were excited. So I thought, huh, I wonder what neuroscience says about change. So I went back and that became book number two, Wired to Resist. And then I realized, oh, I guess I'm doing this. I guess I'm going to be the person who synthesizes neuroscience and brings it to the business world and makes it really applicable. So the natural next place was teams. Teams is how work gets done these days. And you can't talk about teams without getting into inclusion and belonging and all of that. And the science is really fascinating. I know we're going to unpack that a little bit. But prior to that, as a child, I had grown up in an abusive household. My mom had a mental illness, and it meant that we moved every single year. I never went to the same school more than one season, sometimes two schools in a season. So I never really felt like I belonged, and I did a whole lot of trying to fit in. Every school I came to, doing a whole lot of fitting in. And then when I went off to college, I came to Santa Barbara for school, and because I had moved so much in my life, I've never left. Like I got here and just put down roots. But in college is when I had some painful but so precious experiences of learning about white privilege and having those blinders pulled off and realizing that as much as I felt like I didn't belong, that as a white woman, I had all these privileges and really heartbroken when I was learning the truth about other people's experiences. And so I think my commitment to anti-racism work started in college, and it's been a thread through a lot of the things I've done professionally. So of course you can't write a book about teams and belonging without getting into microaggressions and bias and all the stuff that, you know, we all walk around with. So
that origin story is so important to understand. I think it also can help us learn and grow about ourselves. And when that applies to our work, it becomes even more powerful. So I'm glad to hear about that, but also the shifts that you've been able to make in your career and the connections through this lens of neuroscience and now really focusing on teams, as you say, well, work gets done. And I always say that the sense of belonging really is in connection with other people.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the podcast is called Inclusion Begins With Me. So, you know, it's like, what is the role of each person? And I know we're going to really get into that. I'd like to shift a little bit to the culture of belonging. We're hearing so much about belonging. Britt, could you give me your definition of belonging first, of what you think it is? And then I want to ask you, do you think it's a spectrum around belonging, and why is it so important?
So in its simplest form, belonging is that feeling of being part of something and mattering to others. And it's the mattering part, that they care about us, that they would notice if we weren't feeling okay. They would notice if we were missing. Really feeling like you authentically belong in a community. So we're wired for that. We're wired to need that. We're essentially a tribal species designed to live and work and love other people in community. A lot of our biology is dedicated to that.
Britt's books and her work focus on how our brains and bodies have evolved and how we can best support ourselves based on that knowledge. She says the modern world can be very confusing based on the way our brains work. We were once constantly part of a tribe, but now we go back and forth between different groups and different feelings of belonging and exclusion.
So I think you can go through your day and call your best friend and have a moment of feeling like you're belonging. And then you walk into a work meeting, and depending on what that team feels like to you, you don't belong. And then you connect with another team and you feel very much like you belong. And then you watch the news about how your race is treated and you don't feel like you belong. And then you go to your neighborhood and you feel like you're really connected. And then something else, you know, so I think we live in these concentric circles, some of which we have control of and some of which we don't. And then we have the feels of that, whether our community is truly accepted and appreciated and that we belong there.
So if we're wired for connection, which I know your research, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that, why culturally are we, especially in the Western part of the world, so focused on being independent and kind of trailblazing on our own. We celebrate, you know, when someone is the first, and I'm not saying all of us, but the dominant thoughts around this has been, you know, you can do it, go it alone, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, all of these different myths around being human and in society. Yet what I'm hearing from you is this natural, innate part of us is to really be in community with others. And so is that a battle that we're having? Like, why do we think we need to be off somewhere on our own and not in community? And I'm not saying that, you know, our full existence, we're always with people, because I know we do have moments of isolation, alone time that we need. But why is that belief so prevalent, especially also in leadership?
First of all, when we just like look at us as biological beings, and you get into the structures in our brain and the parts that of our body that are designed, we are literally designed to be in community. Like, we have individual zones of neurons in our brain that read parts of the face and are interpreting emotion and trying to figure out what someone is feeling, so we have empathy. We have this mirror neuron system that allows us to feel what other people are feeling and also learn by watching them doing something. When you watch somebody do something, that same region for that activity for your brain is lighting up. And I could go on and on and on. I go into it in the book, but there's just tons of biology around. We are wired to be in community, supporting each other, reading each other's emotions, knowing where we are in the tribe. There's a big part of our biology that is tracking where we are, and we're really sensitive to starting being marginalized. It causes a lot of feelings of distress in the body, because back in our tribal days, when we were living off the land, if you were ousted from the tribe, your chances of survival went way down. So we are also designed to make sure that we're staying connected to this community. And that then leads to parts of it too, which is, you know, how we feel about each other comes from how our leaders tell us to feel about each other. So leaders can set up, you know, high competition and hatred, or us versus them between groups. And the biology will align with that. We will find it much easier to judge others. It'll be easier to derogate them. It even goes so far that if I feel like I'm part of a group and my team has a win, I get serotonin in my brain when that happens. But if we're set up against an us versus them, when the other team falters or stumbles or loses, I still get serotonin in my brain. So there's a lot of biology around it where we can be set up to be in an us versus them relationship. And many leaders do that, you know, intentionally to create division. And so all that's going on. And then to your second point, we're back to origin story, right? You know, America, you know, that our origin story is splitting off from the United Kingdom and starting a new land and being independent and forging our way. You know, the reality is today that none of us survives without community. Like, it's very, to me, it cracks me up when people are like, I'm individualistic and I did it all on my own. And no, there were farmers who grew your food and then grocers who put it there. And you ordered dinner to go last night and you drove on a road that was paved. You know, you're not out bushwhacking and shooting your dinner and, you know, all the work that is entailed with that. The reason you were able to have the energy and the focus to go do this great thing is because you're standing on all the efforts of a community that are supporting you. And then, of course, it's even more than that, because some people truly only get to where they are because of the commutative efforts of everyone underneath them doing a good job.
It's so important that we really disrupt this thinking about going at it alone and really celebrating and amplifying the importance of being in community and doing that in a way where connecting is energizing, you know, versus connecting being agonizing, or, you know, people having memories of when I'm in this group, this is what comes up for me. You know, one of the things in the book, I wanted to just pivot to this while we're talking about being wired for connection. The impact of isolation and exclusion, are the feelings of that, even when you are on a team and surrounded by others. In your book, you talk about that these feelings of isolation and exclusion light up pain centers in our brain. I mean, it is really physical pain and anguish that we're feeling when we are not connected.
Absolutely.
Or accepted and included, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. So the research here was mind-blowing to the scientists, and then it's mind-blowing when you read about it. So some neuroscientists started studying what happens in the brain when someone experiences exclusion. And so they had folks on MRI machines, and they were giving them a mildly excluding experience. You were playing a game of cyberball with a couple other people, and then your iPad was designed to have you feel like, oh, now the two of them are just playing by themselves and you've been left out of the game. Mild. And the scientists did not expect this, but the part of the brain that was lighting up was the pain center. And so they did a whole bunch more studies. They had both like that on the MRI and other things. They had a group of African-American folks be excluded by members of the Ku Klux Klan. So you'd think, okay, that's not going to matter. That's a community that I don't like or respect. And of course, they're not going to include me. It still lit up pain centers. They had studies where people were talking about previous relationships. They had studies where you were paid to experience exclusion, and it still lit up the pain center. So they did a whole bunch of variety of studies to kind of say, what is this? Mm-hmm. So then the next natural research question is, well, then do pain pills help? And absolutely, it disconnects the feeling of social rejection that you're having.
But what about, you know, when a group of people come together and we have diverse identities and diverse backgrounds, what are the things that need to be done in that environment to truly foster the psychological safety and inclusiveness so that there's this cohesion and sense of belonging and feeling like, you know, my contributions on this team are truly valued? How do we amplify that so that people don't have these feelings of isolation and exclusion? What can we do in team environments, especially diverse team environments, to foster the right things?
Yeah. So, you know, if belonging is the feeling of being part of something and mattering to others, inclusion is how you create it, right? Those are the intentional acts designed to help people feel part of something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, team training, and I'm glad to see so many initiatives happening in the work world around diversity, inclusion, and belonging. But I think people, you know, they can either go, yeah, and check the box, or they can understand, oh no, like this is the recipe for how you create great teams, great workplaces, great innovative companies. It's not just a check the box. It's truly at the heart of what creates the best workplaces. You know, most people, most managers want to create a good environment for their employees. They just don't know how. So a lot of this can be handled with teaching and training. You know, like we're not necessarily given a lot of information about this stuff in school. Some schools are good at it. Some aren't. There's kind of an attack on critical thinking right now happening in schools. So workplaces now, it falls more to them to talk about these subjects and teach these subjects.
So we started an experiment last year as part of our global DEI team, and we call it Endeavor. We've partnered with the Medici Group. The CEO is Franz Johansson, who wrote the book, The Medici Effect. And what we have been doing is taking diverse global teams. Of course, we have a whole nother set of criteria that I will not take people through. But we've been working with these teams and in partnership with the Medici Group and our DEI and learning professionals at MetLife, we've been introducing them to two key things: inclusive behaviors that are necessary for fostering the right type of environment based on the research. And then secondly, introducing them to about four moves that the team learns together. And our first year, we learned a lot from the structure of the program. And we're about to start again with a second cohort. And we're really excited because what we're doing also is adding additional learning so people can come away from those intense experiences that we have with the team. A coach is present and we really get them to try things out. We come back several weeks later, kind of with a check-in, how did things go? But now they have more time to really start to learn and apply. And the goal is really for these teams to know what to do.
Yep.
And know how to come together and build greater psychological safety and cohesion. It's something that I wanted us to try because I knew how important teams are, but it was like we throw teams together and because people are highly functioning, we have, you know, really smart people, we think, oh, smart people will figure it out. But it's emotional.
Right. Well, it's very emotional.
Right?
Well, two things there. Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer that people can and do learn things all their lives. So we can absolutely change behaviors through training. And I love that you've invested in that. And that's a painful journey to awaken to privilege and awaken to how things really are. But once people do, or once they believe their peers or the educational training or whatever, that this is a problem and people feel this way on a day-to-day basis, most people say, oh my gosh, I want to do something about that. Mm-hmm. Then the second question is, but I don't know what to do or I don't want to make a mistake. And so this is when we can give people some of the tools and the actions to engage in micro affirmations.
Yes.
Stop doing microaggressions. Most of them are unintentional, but still harmful. And then intentionally lean into micro affirmations because you want to be proactive in creating an inclusive environment.
Some examples of micro affirmations are things like active listening, validating achievements, and giving coworkers credit for good work.
So once you kind of understand what makes up psychological safety, you can intentionally create it. I've also built a training around this too, and also with the brain science of teams and inclusion. And so giving people those tools, and particularly managers, because they have a position of power, they naturally have a little bit of a barrier to psychological safety with the people that report to them. So you have to teach them that they have to be the ones that are proactive to pierce that barrier and invite people in and just continually send signals that they are open to feedback, that they're appreciative of feedback, that they don't have all the answers, that they highly value their teams.
Okay, I feel great. I am armed with the data to support the continuation of Endeavor. But I do recognize that still being in team environments, no matter how much we may focus on psychological safety, for some people, it is a personal journey to kind of overcome some of the things we've already been through, to know that that happened in the past. It might not be happening now. Any tips on that or insights that you have about managing the here and now versus the yesterday in terms of our feelings and emotions?
Well, absolutely. So for the longest time as a young professional, I was terrible to give a performance review to because I would get so defensive. I would just hear every critique as literally physically threatening. My amygdala would go off. I would feel like I was about to get hit, even though that was not going to happen. So I had to learn that about myself. And I started doing things to take care of myself, like telling my boss my history and saying, when we do performance reviews, I need it to happen at the end of the day. I'm going to listen and not respond. I need to be able to respond later because it's really hard for me to hear. And then I want to go sit with it for 24 hours. I would immediately go out to my car and burst into tears and let myself cry, let myself have all the emotions that my old body was having. And then I'd be able to work my way through being able to listen and then come back with thoughtful questions. But that was, we all have our own personal journeys to manage our own history and do what we need to do to help heal whatever wounds are there.
Britt says making leaders and coworkers aware of our history and what we need is one way to create psychological safety for ourselves.
So absolutely, we can create teams that have this environment. And all of the complexity of that is what makes a great team leader, is that you help your people develop that trust in early meetings. You have sessions where people are sharing about their lives and learning about each other's strengths so that you can then go into meetings where this kind of critique, and essentially that was a learning session. They were learning together.
So speaking of that, challenging ourselves, coming out of the pandemic, we have had to make some shifts. Shifts in how we work, where we work, when we work, who we're working with, all of those things. And really, you know, I think the great resignation and the great reflection intersects. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts around the work models that we're putting forward and really investing in? Because earlier you talked about us being wired to be able to see body language. There's things that happen when we're in community with each other in person. Yet, our new hybrid models are variations of that. It's all virtual. Maybe it's you're coming in 2 or 3 days a week, or there may be a group that's fully face-to-face. What do you think about this? And are there some watchouts? Are there some things that are really great about this model? Would love to get your thoughts as we think about what's going to work during this time.
Let me first speak to this moment in time, like coming out of the pandemic. By the way, the pandemic's not over. It's just
right. Is it an endemic yet?
It's now an endemic, and the disease is still transforming. Mm-hmm. It will become more contagious and less dangerous over time, but we're still in it, and people are still getting sick and dying. So I can't underscore enough the collective trauma that the world has experienced.
Yes.
Like, we have gone through trauma, but we've been so busy getting through the trauma that I don't think everyone's totally aware of the toll it has taken on them physically and psychologically. But what it's leading to is two things. The world is burned out, which happens when you live through trauma. And burnout is exhaustion. You lose your sense of accomplishment or joy from things that used to give you that. And you also have a depletion of empathy and compassion because you just don't have it to give anymore. I think that's what's leading to the great resignation, is that people are just not feeling good. And what they're feeling is burnout, but they think it's the job that used to make them happy, but is no longer making them happy. So therefore, I should go seek a new job. In addition, we went through a global values clarification exercise. Mm-hmm. Like, any cancer survival will tell you that when you face mortality, and we all faced mortality, even if you didn't get sick, many people know someone who's died. It reshifts your priorities. You get really clear about what's important. So right now, there's this whole conversation about purpose and meaningful work. It's always been there for the younger generations, but now it is like a loud beating drum that people are wanting to find that and took a good hard look at where they were working. The third piece is that for many communities, particularly women and people of color and LGBTQIA folks, working from home was a reprieve from all the bullshit.
You know, they were dealing with,
oh my gosh, the microaggressions and the insults and the racism, subtle or not, you know, people got a break from it because they were engaging in each other through this screen. And a lot of that stuff happens in those subtle moments between things. It's not always really overt. So yes, I think a lot of people are pausing and saying, what do I want to be doing? What's meaningful to me? I don't want to go back into that environment. It was not healthy. I want to find a healthier environment. So I think these are all good conversations. And while they're causing some distress for hiring managers, I think it's, you know, companies that have a toxic culture are going to really pay the price for it now. And companies that have always cared about authentic inclusion and belonging are going to keep their people and be a magnet for new people.
According to Britt, companies need to be judicious about how they choose to use in-person time with employees.
Zoom fatigue is real. The reason why we get Zoom fatigue is that right now you and I can see each other, but I see you're a 2-inch square and I can see you only from the collarbone up, right? So even though I'm engaging with you, my body is not getting the data, the full data it would get if you and I were sitting in the room together. So I'm having to work hard. My brain is having to work hard to try to read you more or more accurately, given that I'm missing a lot of the data. I mean, pheromones matter. Brain waves are electrical impulses that pass between us. There's all kinds of body language, even micromuscular differences in the face we cannot see in a 2D world, but we can see in a 3D world. So with that said, yes, this is the reality of the new world, is that we're going to be working virtually. But the bottom line is that the technology has outpaced our biology. Mm-hmm. We were not designed to work this way. We were designed to be together. So what that means for all of us is two things. When you bring teams together, if you can bring them in person first, it will accelerate that trust building, putting marbles in the marble jar when we're in physical space with each other. And then when people have that in place, they can work virtually and be okay because they got a good grounding with each other. And if there starts to be trouble on the team, there starts to be a lot of conflict or dysfunction, bring people together, take them on an offsite, get them into the same room. You and I could totally get a ton of work done using a collaborative online tool and having a couple Zoom meetings. But for our trust building, for our sense of inclusion and belonging with each other, we're going to have to either over-index on virtual meetings that are not about task, but about relationship. Or we're going to need to build in these touch points where we do get together in person occasionally to just kind of rebuild that connective tissue between us and between the team.
Absolutely. So these are great tips. What is one action that you can give all of us that we can try in terms of Wired for Connection and knowing that that's how we are? What's an action that we can immediately take and start using to foster more connection, more sense of belonging for ourselves and others, as well as fostering more inclusion?
Yeah. When it comes to this virtual work world, I would say start thinking about your work in two buckets. What are the tasks? And then what's the relationship building part? And then start using your tools to accelerate each of those. So if we're thinking about a 3-2 schedule or whatever, what we really need to be thinking about is when people are physically together or physically at the office, we should be using that time very intentionally for the things in which in-person biology accelerates, supports, strengthens. Brainstorming, onboarding, having difficult conversations, just hanging out with each other so that we just rebuild our time. And then use the online time for collaboration. And there's so many online tools now that can help us, but make the tasky stuff be there. And the relationship stuff is really what we lean into when we're together. I think we need to be thinking that way. And if you start thinking that way, then you can start to see how you can make your work schedule be more effective. The second part of that is we're in way too many meetings. Meetings really went over the top during the pandemic. And we need to come back down to a more normal and appropriate meeting schedule. People need time to get their work done. And just meetings
is too much.
Too much.
What's appropriate, Britt, when you think about in a day and the neuroscience around it? What's our threshold? What should we really be kind of targeting, and the types of meetings we should be involved in day to day? Because if you have 12 meetings and you're making major decisions in 12 meetings, you know, call the ambulance. I don't know how that's going to work.
But people are in meetings literally.
They
all
are. I am. And I'm like in the meeting saying, why am I here?
Right. Well, there's a whole lot of stuff on good meeting management,
right?
Like clear purpose, agenda, the right people are invited. We can all take care of ourselves by not going to certain meetings. You have the right to reject a meeting and not go to it or not show up to it. So I give you all permission to decide.
Unmeet. That's one of the things that we say. Let's look at your calendar and look at something and you're going to say, I'm going to unmeet. I am not moving through.
I'm not going to go to that. Yeah. Right. That's harder to do if you don't have psychological safety, right? If you feel like there'll be a punishment for that later. So I think it's a good time to have conversations around that. Meetings should always allow a break. So if it's a 30-minute meeting, it should really be a 25-minute meeting, and it should be a 50-minute meeting, because people need time to close the screen. Being on screens is especially exhausting. And then I think, you asked what the threshold is. I don't know how any company gets work done if people don't have about 50% of their time to actually do work versus meeting about the work. So we spend a lot of time talking about the work, but not having time to do the work. So things that I love when companies do is they either create a 2-3 hour block per day when meetings are not allowed. So it's just company norm, no meetings during this 3-hour window. And then everybody schedules stuff in between. Of course, then you have to hold people accountable to that. Other organizations have a no meeting day, like no meeting Mondays or no meeting Fridays. Something like that can be really helpful because it just forces you to contain it and it forces you to make choices around it. And then I think as we're coming back to work and we're thinking about this new hybrid world, it is a great time to just have these conversations, start talking about task versus relationship, how often we need to meet. I think it's a great time to reevaluate how many meetings you're having and who's in them, because we don't assess that often enough. And that should be an annual assessment anyway, so that you're constantly evolving your meeting structure to meet the organization for the work it's currently doing.
Absolutely. And scheduling in there the time to connect and the time for delight and joy and some happiness, you know, that's really important. If we're coming together, and I've been talking to my team about this and trying to be more intentional, when we're together, let's eat together. Let's laugh and talk. We can, and then we have a rule. We can only talk about work so much because it's not a work meeting. It's not a working lunch. This is where we're going to talk about the things that bring us joy. We're going to share with each other. And the team picks the different meals where we will do that. But we have to actually schedule it. We can't make it seem like it's just going to happen. We've really been intentional about, we want this to be part of our team norm and culture.
Yeah. And those are the things that we lost in the pandemic. A lot of that stuff are those water cooler conversations that happen on your way in or out of the meeting, mm-hmm. or the spontaneous things like, oh, hey, you want to go grab a cup of coffee or let's go grab lunch. We lost all that. And that was where all the connective tissue lived for teams, is all those little side moments. It's also where the harassment lived too. Mm. So some of it was good to get rid of, but it's also where the connection happened. And so people have been Zoom fatigued. We've gotten through the bulk of the trauma or the experience of the pandemic. Now, as we're rebuilding and moving forward, we need to think about, where do these informal connection things live and how do we make sure we don't lose them, because they're vitally important. So I love that you guys were doing that naturally. And then it gives people that chance to just have those conversations. What a lot happened to a lot of teams is they literally had no water cooler conversations for a year and a half. Like, it was all just task. And no wonder they're burned out now, right? They're burned out now because we lost access to all those connecting things. We are creatures that hunger to belong. We are wired to connect with each other. We're wired to have fun. We're wired to be with each other. And we lost that. And so we now have to lean in extra to rebuild. And then understand that if you're not feeling excitement about that, it's probably because you're burned out and you're in that state of a little bit of disconnection and exhaustion. And so right now, this next few months is actually a very special and important time.
Just on that point, when you're feeling burned out, when every email that you get, you want to scream at the person or the people copying you with the other 50 people, how do you say, okay, I am clearly annoyed, I am burned out, how do I work on my recovery so that I can get back in there and feel this sense of connection and cohesion with the people that I'm working with? When you recognize those symptoms, do you have any tips at the individual level of what we can do to help recover from those feelings?
Absolutely. Essentially, burnout happens when we are overworking and under-resting. And that's what we did those last 2 years. We leaned in extra to work and we lost access to all the little things that we do to take care of ourselves. That pedicure, the glass of wine with friends, going to your gym class, having a vacation. We are very depleted and under-rested. So the way out of burnout is rest and play. Rest, there's actually 7 different types of rest. Sleep is one of them. And most of us are struggling with sleep right now because it's part of burnout, is you are exhausted but have insomnia. But there's also, so engaging in lots of rest. So yes, you're going to have to invest a little bit in yourself. You're going to have to catch up and rest more. You're going to have to get your vacations in, some extra vacations. We have to restore that which has been depleted, not just keep going from here. And then you got to add play back in. Play signals to the body that you're safe and we lost access to all of our favorite ways to play. And adults tend to underplay in general. So I want everyone to be thinking about, you know, leaning back into play, playfulness, doing things that are fun. And just know, and this happened to me, after doing the research, I realized I was burned out. I would think about something I used to do and I'd be like, yeah, I should go do that. I'm not feeling it. So I wouldn't schedule it. But burnout is going to tell us that we feel meh about it. Schedule it anyway. We have to keep playing. And it's in the playing that you start to go, oh my God, that's so fun. Or that gave me a lift. It's not an overnight fix. We have to restore for a few weeks here before we're start to feel better. But I started using the tips and I could feel a huge difference in myself by just committing to rest and play and realizing it was the medicine I needed. The third thing that's really cool is nature. Nature is a healing tonic. And we have found that the magic formula is at least 20 minutes, three times a week in nature. Our bodies are organic things. And so when we're out in nature, we're getting a lot of stuff from nature, and water in particular is especially helpful. But get out in nature at least 20 minutes, three times a week, and be with nature. That's not on your phone in nature. That is being with
the
nature.
It's not the Calm app, but be in nature. You have just confirmed several things. So I'm so glad that I'm making space to be. My favorite places are in nature and on the lake, just kind of sitting and staring and collecting and enjoying the breeze and watching birds and all kinds of stuff. So finding what things that delight you, energize you, and play, and making time for rest. Britt, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much. I have like 57 topics that I want you to come back and talk about. But thank you so much for coming today, sharing with us, giving us really great tips that we can use, and raising our awareness that we are wired for connection and we should really grab onto it, hold onto it, nurture it, and make sure that it is part of our day-to-day. So thank you, and we'll have you back.
Thank you. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you all for joining me on this episode of Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. Dr. Britt Andriotta is an author and speaker on brain science and connection. Links to her books and webinars on the topics we discussed today are in our show notes. Learn more about MetLife's commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion on MetLife.com. All the links are in our show notes. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. I hope you also take the time to rate and leave our show a review. Before we go, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, Human Group Media, who helped us produce this show. That's it for today. I hope you join me next month for a brand new episode.